I'll be speaking today after the 1:30 screening of Steal the Story, Please at the IFC in the Village. We'll be doing the Q&A with the co-director, Carl Diehl. I'll also be speaking tonight at the Q&A after the screening of the film at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. Tomorrow we head to Los Angeles, where we'll be at the different Lemley theaters, and then to San Francisco this weekend to be at the Roxy in San Francisco, at the Rialto in San Rafael, and in Berkeley. You can go to democracynow.org to see all the details. This is the first week of Steal the Story, Please, the film screening around the country. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 on your FM dial. K296FT West Haven serving Portland at 107.1 on your FM dial. And K219KU Nahalem serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 on your FM dial. Streaming live and archive, baby, at xray.fm. Radio is yours.
A correction for this episode. The Ghost Town Monthly Poetry Open Mic is on the second Thursday of the month, not the second Tuesday, as reported in this episode.
Adriana Baer and KXRW present I'm Into This Place.
Welcome to National Poetry Month. Every year in April, we gather to celebrate the spoken and written word. Since its founding in 1996, National Poetry Month has actually grown to be the largest literary celebration in the world. Right here in Clark County, there's a group that gathers to celebrate the written word every single month, and they are considered by many to be the heart center of poetry in our region. This is Ghost Town Poetry Open Mic, which was founded in 2004 by Christopher Luna, one of our guests today. Christopher was Clark County's inaugural poet laureate, and he's considered by some to be our local godfather of poetry. In fact, that's the title that our other guest today, Morgan Page, another wonderful poet and writer, gave to Christopher when her son was born. Christopher is her son's godfather of poetry. Godmother of poetry, the other Ghost Town co-host, Tony Lumbrazo Luna. These wonderful poets host an open mic every single month at Art at the Cave Gallery. On the second Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can read your own poem, a song you wrote, a tribute, or just sit and listen to the words of the people in our community. There's always a featured guest, and this month, that featured guest is Derek Sheffield, who's the current Poet Laureate of Washington State. Ghost Town at its core is really about the community. Being a space for people to just be together, be themselves, be artists. You know, when you think about open mic nights, you might be thinking of the sort of stereotypical dark coffee shop. Everyone's wearing black. They're going, and snapping a lot. And then there's the poet. They're up on stage with a kind of tattered old microphone, like definitely a beret, reading a very pretentious piece of work out of a tiny black notebook. Yeah, Ghost Town isn't anything like that. The Art at the Cave is a beautiful, bright gallery space on Evergreen in Vancouver. There are lots of joyful people. Sure, there's some snapping, but it's a gathering space for people to just be together, surrounded by art and listening to art, and it's extremely welcoming. I joked that I probably spoke less in this interview than any other I've done. I was so taken with the way that Christopher and Morgan speak about their own work and of the world. So I'm going to let them take it from here. Welcome to I'm Into This Place, your deep dive into the local arts, culture, and heritage of Clark County. From fabulous new restaurants to quirky art installations to the historical sites you never even knew to look for, we're inviting you along. Whether you're a Clark County connoisseur or just starting to get to know her, get ready to fall head over heels for this place we call home. I'm your host, Adriana Baer, and I'm into this place. Let's go.
Christopher Morgan, thank you so much for welcoming me into your world. I'm so excited to talk to you guys both today about poetry, poetry in Clark County, the writers community, all of it.
Thank you for having us.
So let's start with both of you as writers, as poets. What's the generative seed for you in your work?
I am actually a fortunate human being to know what my path was at a very young age. I knew that I was a poet because I wrote this poem for my grandmother, and I was so proud of myself because I wrote about this angel and the wings were white, and I was explaining all of this for her. She is an immigrant from Germany, and so she wrote poetry in both German and English. I always wanted to emulate her as a kid, and I didn't know how important poetry would become to my life, but I just knew that was part of my path. And there's such a cool memory that comes to mind. When I was in high school and I was in a creative writing class, we went to the library at some point to perform the poems that we had written in the class. And this was such a big deal. I was a very shy person. I did not want to perform. I hated giving presentations. It was horrible. But when we went and we invited our family to come to this reading, and it was a whole thing. When we went, I remember reading the poem that I had then written for my mother. My roses grow with an amethyst tint, reflections of my mother's eyes, very Emily Dickinson-esque. Everyone had performed their pieces, and it was very, you know, everyone was shy and shaky. And I got up there, and for some reason, my voice carried throughout the whole building and out of the building, to the point where everyone came up to me after, and I'm 15, maybe 16, and congratulated me. And at that point, I knew, I was like, whoa, I am on to something, and something just happened that was a spark in my life. And so I knew that this spark of aliveness, I didn't know what it was, but I wanted more of that. And then flash forward, I kind of went into hiding with my work. And then it was when I met Chris and he handed me this flyer for Ghost Town Poetry. I knew that that was a turning point. It was a pivotal turning point in my life, in my poetic life, because I knew it was time to share again.
I got chills when you were talking about your voice resonating in the library and people seeing you and you feeling strong and centered and powerful in your words. I want to hear from you, Chris. For you, what was that spark of writing?
So I knew I was a writer at 11. When I was 11, I was reading a lot of Stephen King and a lot of John Irving. They were the two authors who made me want to be a writer. And so I guess my writing at that time was, you know, like short fiction that was sort of imitations of Twilight Zone and horror movie type stuff. And then when I was in my 20s, I read Allen Ginsberg's collected poems and Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. I can realize now that that determined the course of the rest of my life. It's like I was grabbed by the lapels by poetry and pulled into the future. So I ended up going to the school that Ginsberg started in 74 with Diane DePrima and Ann Waldman. It's called the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. Ginsberg was still alive when I first visited it. There was a week-long tribute to him. And I met a person there who is sort of a protege of Ginsberg's. His name was Antler. At the end of that week-long tribute to Ginsberg, he gave me a hug and he said, "Make poetry your life." And I don't know if anyone has ever said anything like that to you. But I kind of took it as a command, and then that's what happened. But the thing about Ginsberg is that I do love the work, but it was also important who he was as a person, because Ginsberg supported lots of other poets. And because he became a world famous poet in his 20s, he could have just like sort of sat on that and kept all that attention and the money that came from it to himself. But he spread it around and he used it to help other people. There's a story about him taking a satchel of his work and other people's work into New York publishers and basically saying, "This is who you should be publishing." So I'm trying to sort of carry on that spirit of what Ginsberg did as an individual to be that person that can just sort of support poetry wherever I find it and support other poets wherever I find them. And it's not, it doesn't even have to be my cup of tea. I believe so much. I'm so passionate about poetry that I want to help other poets. And then in terms of the personal work, I do a kind of like observational kind of poetry, based on the ideas that Ed Sanders had about investigative poetry, which is basically using the skills of a historian or a journalist to do narrative poems. So I've done some of that. I did that to engage with Vancouver when it was new to me and strange. And I called those the Ghost Town poems. 10 years of working on those. I like to do surreal poems, although you can't force those. You have to do them when they're ready to come. And I do these, I like prose poetry very much and will write original prose poems and also do what I call collage poems. But thinking about where does like poetry come from, teaching it, one of the things I got from that is people that are not writers think that novelists and poets like get fully formed works that are like in their head and then they just sort of like dump them onto the paper. But it turns out that poetry is an exploratory process. Like we write to find out what's inside. We write to understand the world around us.
Yes.
And, in terms of the craziness that's going on in the world right now, and which has always been going on, I think a lot about this and talk to my students about this. There are people out there who are feeling as angry and as upset and as confused as we are, who don't have the same facility with the language that a writer has. So you're performing a public service by getting those feelings down on paper or reading them at a public poetry reading. Because there will be people in that audience and also people in the community around you who would like to say those things but don't have the means to say it. So I really feel like that's an important role for poets, to bear witness and then to speak to the things that everybody is thinking about, upset about, concerned about, but in a public way. Something about that is really important for the populace, for the citizenry, because there are some people who need to change their minds about things or to see things more clearly, which is one thing poetry helps you do before they will feel ready to take to the streets or whatever it is that they're going to do to make the world a better place. And I see that happen every month at Ghost Town. Everybody needs to be heard and seen, but there's also things that people need to hear, right? So it's almost like a healing feedback loop. It's a great thing about the open mic format. We don't know what people are going to say before they show up, what poems they're going to read. The last Ghost Town poetry was the day after Renee Good was murdered by ICE. And so half a dozen of the poems were about that. And because it turned out that this particular time that ICE murdered somebody, that it was a poet, someone read her poem, the poem that won an award. So people wrote about her and also shared her words. And I feel like we're fortunate to have a place where people feel safe to do that. And where when something that serious has just happened, that we have a way to address it publicly and maybe even think about, could we do anything to help? And it will help you to have gotten out of the house and to be reminded that I'm not the only person on the planet who's feeling this way right now. And then we're a long event. So that was just a few of the things that were read. That's what's wonderful about the open mic format is it's all over the map in terms of content. And it wouldn't be good if it was 3 hours of poems about a tragedy, right?
Poetry leads to connection. It's a radical form of resistance when we're sitting, getting to know our own feelings about something and getting to know where we stand on something. And then we share it. Our personal experience becomes universal because we look each other in the eyes and we say, look, we have the same needs. We need to connect. And so if poetry can be that bridge of connection, of helping people not feel alone in this world, like, oh my gosh, there's so many times during the open mic that so many people are moved to tears because they don't feel alone anymore.
There's a bunch of things on the flyer to let people know that it's a safe space. One of them is LGBTQ+ friendly. I put that on there because I want people in those communities to know that it's safe for them, but I wouldn't put it on there if I didn't think that it was true. And this is what the Vancouver community has done for 20-something plus years, because we've had trans and queer readers and features the whole time. And I paid close attention to how those people were treated while they were in the room. And I've never even heard a person say an unkind word about a trans person out of earshot.
I love that list. I'm going to read it. It's okay. Anti-fascist, anti-racist, LGBTQ+ friendly, pro-science, pro-choice, all ages, and uncensored since 2004. I love it.
Well, before we had Ghost Town, there was no title for the series.
Why Ghost Town?
Because I'm from New York, 24 hours a day, there are people everywhere. And so when I got to Vancouver, it freaked me out that I could walk around the street in the middle of the day and not see any people. it started out as a sarcastic nickname, like a New Yorker being a jerk and saying this place is a ghost town. But then it became like a badge of honor where Vancouverites know that there's this bigger, cooler, hipper city right across the river. We also know that some of the people there have some weird ideas about Vancouver and look down on it. And so ghost town poetry is a way of saying, we don't need your validation. And there's a lot of great art stuff happening over here. I guess those ghost town poems, I mean, I was sort of like doing fish out of water, you know, New Yorker in Vancouver trying to understand this place. But what they mostly were, because when I was first in ghost town and I didn't have a car, I was taking the bus and I was also pushing my son around in his stroller and people would see us, you know, doing that, was engaging with this new place and engaging with what was outdoors and writing, you know, direct observational poetry about it. One of my obsessions right now is how I feel like all writing is time travel, but there's also a kind of writing where you write in real time about things that are happening in front of you as they happen. And that's kind of what the ghost town poems are. In most cases, I am walking around the community and writing about what I see as I'm walking around.
With every story you became.
You're listening to I'm Into This Place on KXRW 99.9 FM. Host Adriana Baer will be back with her guests, poets Christopher Luna and Morgan Page, after a word from our sponsors.
Support for KXRW comes from Kindred Vancouver, in the Uptown Village neighborhood. Kindred is a community-focused general store offering bulk refillery options and supplies for sustainable, do-it-yourself living. With a focus on reducing waste and supporting clean, mindful lifestyles, Kindred helps individuals incorporate low-impact choices into daily life. More information is at kindredvancouver.com.
KXRW programming is made possible by partners like Buckley & Associates, attorneys at law, helping injured victims seek the justice they deserve for over 40 years. Licensed in Washington State, our diverse team speaks over 7 languages, making your rights more accessible and easier to understand. Learn more at buckleylaw.net. Buckley & Associates, we speak your language.
우리는 여러분의 언어를 구사합니다.
我们说你的语言.
Nosotros hablamos tu idioma.
중도의 nói ngôn ngữ của bạn.
Welcome back to I'm Into This Place on KXRW 99.9 FM. Host Adriana Baer's conversation with her guests, poets Christopher Luna and Morgan Page, now continues.
I'd like to circle back briefly to what you started with, Morgan, which was this idea of speaking the poetry out loud. Because there's something extremely different about writing poetry to be silently read by somebody and writing poetry to be read aloud either by you or by somebody else. When we talk about, you know, sharing these words in community, you are speaking about sharing these words out loud from your mouth, your body into the space. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, for me, and I've thought about this a lot because I've been getting into a lot of energetics, metaphysics, frequency, and how things resonate, why they resonate, what is resonant about, you know, connection of one person to another, and what's dissonant. There's something so rhythmic about speaking poetry aloud, whether it's rhyming or not. And there's something that's very musical in that. But I think there's something that that does as we receive it to our energetic field. And also as we're vibrating out, you know, it's a reciprocity, an energetic reciprocity that's happening that is healing us in the moment. Whether we know we're being healed or not, it's healing if we're open to receiving. And when you're in a room with a microphone and somebody is, you know, vibrationally, rhythmically speaking, you're receiving. And so I think that's why people show up, and it, because it resonates, because there's this frequency that's matched and there's this reciprocity. And I think that that is strengthening the human web of connection, you know, and it gives me great hope and inspiration to like experience that in real time. It really allows us to connect as humans. And I think like in a greater, bigger picture sense, poetry connects us with our humanity. What is important for us as humans is to feel. We must keep feeling. And so anything that helps remind us of how to feel and the fact that we are feeling humans, yes, write it. But then when you share it, I'm feeling something different when I share it. And I know that I'm receiving what that feeling was on the page in a different way as well. So it's like, yeah, it connects us to our humanity.
This is why I hang out with her.
I mean, for real.
I'd like to piggyback on that. I feel like performance is very important to me. When I can, I read with musicians. That's my favorite way to present it. But even when you're up there by yourself, you know, poetry is an oral tradition, and there's two ways to sort of experience it. You're either reading it to yourself, and I encourage my students to read the poems they're reading for fun and their own writing out loud because of this oral tradition. But often we're just doing it silently or in the air. And so if you read it out loud, that's the other place that poetry happens. And as a performer, even if you haven't been doing it for very long, it's a full body experience. You will feel things in your entire body. And I think that you can learn over time to tune into what else is happening in the room without losing your place in the poem. And this is regardless of whether you memorize or not. I'm not somebody who memorizes my poetry, even though performance is very important. I always have some kind of text to work from. If you could tune into what's happening in the audience, there are all kinds of things energetically that you can pick up. And one of the things that you learn over time is how to tell whether you have them or not. I really feel like art is a one-to-one ratio. Like, I feel like my job is to reach one of those people out there, no matter how many there are. And it's sort of like all the rest of them are gravy, right? If you get more than one, then you're really cooking with gas. Right now, the world is suffering from people feeling isolated from each other. This technology that's supposed to bring us together, is all the data tells us that it's not helping with that. It's actually making things worse. So it's important for people, whether they go to poetry readings or whether they do other things that make them happy, things that they enjoy, to leave your house and go outside and go and be among other humans. You will find almost immediately when you gather with other humans that they are more pleasant, more interesting, and more complex than anything that's on your telephone, right? And so that's super important to do right now. And we're living in a dangerous time. And so I think making contact with real humans is one of the things that will help to save us from this danger and get us out of this danger. I also think for writers, sometimes I say to the writers in my workshops, go outside and take a walk to the end of your block or to the end of your driveway. The poem might be waiting for you there. This is a time in our history where it's really important to go outside. Whatever that means for you or to you, that is helping people right now. I'd say if you're feeling sad and lonely and alone, come to Ghost Town or just go outside and you'll start to feel things open up for you.
At the end of every episode, I ask our guest, what place or person are you really into these days? But before we hear their response, I just wanted to let you know that you can find out all about our guests and the wonderful work that they're doing by visiting imintothisplace.com and clicking on episodes. There you'll find tons of information about the incredible arts and culture in our community, find links to the organizations we feature on the show, and you can also sign up for our weekly newsletter. That's where we send you an email every Tuesday highlighting the arts and culture in our community and giving you a list of specially curated events that are coming up this week in Clark County. Okay, let's hear the answer to my favorite question.
Who are you really into these days?
I'm really into Niche Wine Bar, which is owned by Leah Jackson, who's the person who's been supporting my art and this arts community for a very long time. It's a place where you can see art, gather with community, There are books to read. There is a book club. There are writing workshops. There are all kinds of things going on there all the time. And Leah Jackson is one of the people that made that downtown Vancouver Arts District what it is. So Niche Wine Bar is what I'd like to recommend.
Also second that, but I would also say Paper Tiger Coffee Roasters, excellent coffee, excellent art. They've been showing art in this area for many, many years, even with the change of ownership. You got to check out.
This was a really moving and meaningful conversation, and I just really appreciate you both so much sharing your voices with me and also with our community. I have loved being in the room at Ghost Town. I look forward to being in the room again, and I know that you are both rocks for this community, for this literary community, and I can't wait to just hear more words. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And now let's hear from you. This is our Community Voices segment where you call in to shout out your favorites in local arts, culture, and heritage. Community Voices is sponsored by Johnson Bixby, Vancouver's woman-owned, women-led financial planning and portfolio management firm, helping you plan for and celebrate life's possibilities. Advisory services by Johnson Bixby, SEC registered. Securities through Private Client Services, member FINRA, SIPC.
Hey there, my name is Stephanie, and I just gotta say, I love Vault 31, the video game bar. It's one of my favorite places to go. They have all sorts of games, new and old. They have PC games, they have console games. They got everything under the sun. Their food is fantastic. They do super awesome cocktails and specials. And they also have a sister cafe called Don't Die Cafe. So, go check them out, Vault 31. It's a great place to be.
Hi, this is Marianne with Dandelion Tea House and Apothecary, and I give a shout out to all the vintage shops, especially our next door neighbor, Eras. It's just so fun shopping the past and finding those little treasures that make our homes and our lives so great.
We'd love to hear from you. What are your favorite spots in Clark County? Who really deserves a shout out? Give us a call and leave a message or send us a voice note via email. All the details on how to do that are in the show notes. I'm Into This Place is produced and edited by me, Adriana Baer. Engineering and mixing by Sean Lee Martin. This episode was recorded at the home of Christopher Luna, founder of Printed Matter Vancouver and the Ghost Town Poetry Open Mic. Find out more about us and them at imintothisplace.com. See you out there.
Thanks for listening to I'm Into This Place on KXRW 99.9 FM. The radio production of this show featured songs by Towers, which are listed in the show's description. We're going to end the show with more from Towers' new album, The Shape of Letting.
And sheltered from the gale. Now everything's burning, panning for faith. Clock arms are tired. Shall pass. This too shall pass. This too shall pass. This too shall pass.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from Spielman Bagels and Coffee. Opened by Rick Spielman and his son, Raph, Spielman's has been serving handmade boiled and baked bagels and house-roasted coffee since 2011 in their flagship store located on Southeast 20th and Division Street. More information and hours at SpielmanBagels.com.
My name is Ray, and I became homeless at 15. Years later, when I tried to get off the streets, someone told me about Transition Projects and its mission to help people from homelessness to housing. Transition Projects set me up with a case manager who gave me something I hadn't had for years, someone who believed in me. They got me into housing and access to mental health and addiction resources. 12 years later, I'm a proud Transition Projects employee overseeing a team of case managers like the one who helped me. More information at tprojects.org.
Today on Wings.
Nobody came down off of a mountain with stone tablets that said the only way to make money off the internet is to spy on people.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
If you're going to create a censorship magic wand, you also have to look at who you're handing it to. And I think that this is another reason why we want a multiplicity of places where people can build safe communities for themselves rather than creating a big censorship stick and handing it to anybody, but certainly not the current federal government.
This is Suki Wessling of The Babblery. Cindy Cohen, the executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has led the fight for online privacy for nearly 30 years. Cohen joined the nonprofit in 1993 when she was asked to lead a lawsuit against the United States Department of Justice in a groundbreaking case regarding cryptography. And if you want to hear her talk technicalities, she's fully able to do so. But I reached out to Cindy to ask if I could engage her in a much more accessible conversation about women's online privacy. She readily agreed to join me and says that there are deep systemic problems with the way we interact with the internet.
We didn't get into the problems with the internet with just one thing, so there isn't just one quick fix, but there are a few things we could do that would make things much better. And the first is comprehensive privacy protection.
In this episode, you'll hear one thing right away. Cindy Cohen is, as you'd expect from EFF, a fierce defender of online privacy and free speech. In this conversation, we explore some of the common arguments in favor of restricting online privacy and how guaranteeing privacy and freedom of speech for all bumps up against personal freedoms and safety. I started by asking Cindy to define what online privacy is.
So I think of privacy as maybe a little different than some people do. Some people think of privacy like the Harry Potter invisibility cloak that you throw over your head, you know, when you're about to do something, you don't want somebody else to find out about it. Well, you know, privacy does that. I'm not saying it doesn't. But the reason I think privacy is important and far more important than that is because privacy is a way that people with less power can have a zone of protection from people who have more power. And I think about this from the very smallest to the very biggest level. On the very smallest level, my colleague, Eva Galperin, works with domestic violence victims, you know, a lot of women. And what do they find out? They find out that their abusers have put malware on their devices so that they can track them all the time, so that they don't have any privacy against their abusers. And they need privacy in order to plot their escape, in order to literally protect their lives from someone who's abusing them. That's how privacy works literally in people's houses. And then you can scale, you know, halfway, which privacy is how we get protection from the corporations who increasingly want to use all the information they know about us to say, decide how much we're going to pay for things and maximize how much we might want to pay, or decide what options we get when we're searching for a job, and those kinds of things that are more on the commercial side. But just as important, they have more power because they know more about us, and they use that power, they can leverage that power against us. And then out a little bigger, and you think about your role as a citizen, you know, we have the private vote in America, we have a secret ballot, so that powerful people can't force you to vote for the person they want you to vote for. So it's your decision not theirs. And those powerful people could be anywhere from your husband to your employer to the government in power. But that's why we have a private ballot in the United States. But it's also the way that people organize to make change. Every public fight for social justice in the United States has needed to have a private space for it to grow. And in my lifetime, we've watched gay rights, for instance, go from something that really people had to talk about in private because it was not popular and people could, you know, literally be attacked for standing up for these things, to the place where, you know, hopefully we can keep it, but the United States Supreme Court has recognized gay marriage and gay people have rights that are much closer to what they deserve than they had when this started out. But every public fight for people's rights has had to have a private dimension, especially in the early days. And I think people are seeing that now in the current administration, maybe a little more than they did in the past. People are recognizing that you need to use a privacy protective tool in order to organize and plan things, because otherwise it will get intercepted by people with more power who want to make sure that we all stay weak and powerless and unable to make changes to our government.
I asked Cindy about the current Republican-led state intrusion into medical records, specifically in the areas of pregnancy and transgender health, but with hints that they could cast the net more widely. These intrusions of women's privacy happened after the case that enshrined abortion rights, Roe v. Wade, was overturned. Some argue that the case was weak because it rested on privacy, which is not explicitly guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution. Cindy disagrees.
I think that when the Fourth Amendment says you deserve to be secure in your papers, your home, and your effects, that's what it means. But we don't have the Supreme Court interpreting it that way as much as we should right now. And that's some of the work that EFF and others are doing in the courts, but that really we do need people to recognize that, you know, the word privacy doesn't have to be in the Constitution. Privacy protective ideas are woven throughout our Constitution, and they can exist in statutes even if they're not in the Constitution. I think it's a little naive of folks to think that one strategy would have won where the other strategy lost so badly. I think the answer to that is that we need to shore up privacy even more, not to abandon privacy as a thing we care about because we don't have tools right now written down in the way that we might want to.
Cindy points out that the internet as we know it today was not designed with our rights in mind, and that's the source of many of the problems that we face, especially when it comes to commercial entities gathering our data.
I love technology. I love the benefits that technology can give to us. But the fact that we can click a box that says, oh, I hereby waive not only my privacy rights, but I want to be able to do blah, 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 blah. Like it's all mushed together in one click box, right? Like that's not okay. We need to have all the tools and we need to have the legal and policy structures that stand with us for those tools as well. And some of that information sharing should be a lot harder or a lot clearer to people about what they're doing, a lot harder to have just one click box mean, you know, 20 million different things at once, some of which are important and some of which are unimportant. You know, I just think that there's a way we can structure the world so that we can have the benefits of technology without so much of the bad sides. I mean, nobody came down off of a mountain with stone tablets that said the only way to make money off the internet is to spy on people, right? And yet, that seems to be the predominant business model. Well, that may take some law that says, you know, you can't have surveillance as a business model anymore. I think the goal ought to be to protect users and give them new technologies. I think that's doable in maybe 90% of the problems that we're all facing right now. And then there's the hard 10%.
That hard 10% often falls on the most vulnerable: minorities, queer folks, historically oppressed people, and, of course, women. One place where women differ from men is in healthcare, where we have to make decisions that collide with political ideology. Cindy sees women's privacy and freedom of speech as core values that we need to protect.
People who are seeking reproductive assistants need access to information, and we're seeing increasing censorship of that information by the sources that people normally go to, whether that's social media or even private websites. EFF just did a big report about censorship of reproductive information, and we found that even though the terms of a lot of these companies would, on their surface, mean that this information is available, and of course it's First Amendment protected, people were having access problems. People were having their websites taken down. People were having their Facebook groups taken down. And so even in the context of what's legal, there's a gap between what these companies say they're doing and what they're actually doing as a result, I think, largely of pressure.
In the U.S., Republican-led states are leading the way not only in trying to restrict access to information, but also in using women's online activity to track them and charge them with crimes related to reproductive health.
People are being prosecuted and tracked down based upon their online footprint or even their offline footprint. Things like license plate readers and other offline surveillance are disproportionately aimed at people who are seeking reproductive care, which is a lot of women. So this is a specific area where I think women just seeking healthcare information or healthcare are finding that the lack of privacy and the censorship issues are getting in the way.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation focuses on a few different ways to protect women's online privacy. One is through legal action, but they also focus on education and creating easy-to-use tools.
A lot of online harassment and targeting is aimed at women. EFF has worked with groups around the world to try to put together security trainings for people, and whether that harassment is due from somebody in their own home or somebody outside. So the surveillance self-defense materials are a good place for people to start to kind of set things up to help protect themselves, to be able to get access to the information they need to communicate without having this risk of attack.
Every woman who's online has noticed that the sorts of abuse that people get in response to posting online may be equally vicious, but women get a particularly targeted kind of abuse, often threatening specific physical and sexual violence against her body or revealing information about her that makes her vulnerable. I asked Cindy to weigh in on how this abuse, which is free speech being exercised by men, curtails the free speech of women, who are justifiably more concerned about opening themselves up to threats of intimate violence when they post.
You know, we took an offline problem where women's protection and women's protection from abuse was not handled seriously by law enforcement and people in power. And we moved it over into the online world, and we're experiencing the same kind of situation in which people whose job it is to help protect us and keep us safe from abuse are rotten at it in the offline world, and they're rotten at it in the online world. I just think it's really important. Like, women have had to publish under pseudonyms for years, right? Because of things like that. So I think that one of the problems is there's just not very much recourse offline or online to women being harassed. And so your ability to come after an abuser and get them to stop is, the tools are not great, right? And they need to be better. Like, you need to be able to get a restraining order against someone for online behavior and have it stick. And again, the problem of restraining orders not working very well is not an online problem. It's a problem in general of the way our society is slanted in ways that protect this kind of abuse. And so I tend to look at that, like, how can we make those tools better so that they're actually available, so that women who are facing this kind of things just don't get shrugged at by the law enforcement, if these are actual threats, or on these online communities. I think the other thing that we believe strongly in is having a multitude of places where you can speak and participate. So if one isn't serving you, you can go somewhere else without losing your whole community. This is part of the reason why EFF is very supportive of some of the communities like Mastodon or Blue Sky or other kinds of communities that are not corporate controlled and don't have a surveillance business model. It's to let people be able to build communities that serve them rather than being you know, stuck in these huge communities where there's a lot of abusers. You know, we've seen an exodus of people, of women especially, off of X, because there's so much abuse there. And luckily, there's some other places that they can go where it's less. It's still not great, but it's better. And I just think that the world in which there are two or three commercial privacy invasive products that try to do content moderation for the whole world, it's never going to work very well. Content moderation at scale is not going to work very well. So what do we need to do? We don't need to make the dictators nicer dictators. We need to get rid of dictators and have multiple options for people. I just think that expecting Mark Zuckerberg to get magically better at protecting women online, even if he wanted to, and I don't know, is going to be hard because of just the sheer scale and the difficulty of doing content moderation at scale and doing it in a way that doesn't throw the babies out with the bathwater. The other problem with this is the way that some of these companies are starting to be pushed towards limiting what people can say online isn't in the ways that maybe, you know, you and I would write if we got asked to write it. It's in the hands of the people in power. And right now, what does that mean? That means marginalized people are getting over-censored, even while the people who are the actual people that I think you and I might agree need more censorship are not. So you have to be careful if you're going to create a censorship magic wand. You also have to look at who you're handing it to. And I think that this is another reason why we want a multiplicity of places where people can build safe communities for themselves rather than creating a big censorship stick and handing it to anybody, but certainly not the current federal government.
This is Suki Wessling of The Babblery, and you're listening to Wings. We're speaking with Cindy Cohen, Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, about women's online privacy. Cindy and EFF stand against forcing social media to use moderation tools, and that might seem to be the place where they diverge from a common feminist approach. I asked Cindy to address the question that you hear women asking a lot. Wouldn't it just be easier if we required people to use their real names in online social spaces?
Look, they have done scientific research about anonymity, and we have a gigantic example in front of us, which is Facebook, right? Which requires real names. People aren't nicer to each other. This idea that anonymous speech allows people to be meaner to each other or to harass people more isn't actually borne out by the research. And I don't think it's actually borne out if people step back and look at it. People aren't nicer to each other on Facebook than they are on other platforms. So I think even our lived experience, if you step back and think about it, is not consistent with this idea that anonymity is the problem. Right now, we have people who harass with impunity. You can find them. It's not actually all that hard to find most of them. I mean, the number of people who can legitimately handle being untraceable online if they're engaging in a campaign in harassment, it's very small. It's that they're not being caught. It's that nobody's trying to catch them. It's that the cops say, oh, there's a VPN, there's nothing I can do. Of course there is. When they're trying to go after drug dealers, they can go past a VPN, right? Like, so I just think it's a problem of will and enforcement and not a problem of the technology. It's because historically, women's concerns about harassment haven't been taken seriously by the people who are supposed to protect us. And I think until we address that problem, all the getting rid of anonymity in the world is going to end up hurting those marginalized people. Look, EFF does human rights work all around the world. The ability to sneak information out of a repressive government and using anonymity, VPNs, tools like Tor, it saves lives. We wouldn't know the things we know about the Taiwanese fight for freedom. We work with a lot of Chinese democracy people. Now we've got people in Ukraine. We've got people in Gaza. We've got people, all over the world, Sudan, people all over the world who need to get information out of very scary places where there is official censorship. They need these tools and they rely on these tools. And if we decide that because cops aren't willing to investigate harassment, we're going to get rid of these tools, I think we're cutting off the people we're hurting. You know, it's not the right move. to remove anonymity from everybody because some people misuse it. We have other tools to deal with abusers, but lots of people would like you to think that there's a technological fix for this. And if we just remove anonymity online, it'll all be well. I'm here to tell you, I don't think that's going to work. And you're going to hurt a lot of people along the way. And some of those are the same people you think you're helping.
It may sound sexist to say this, but it's literally not. One of the places where women's privacy is most violated is in online shopping. We are more likely to shop for our entire household rather than just ourselves. I asked Cindy to talk about the ways we're being tracked and the results of that tracking.
You know, there's a lot of tracking of us. There's also a lot of analysis of other people like us and people who we communicate with. Sometimes, you know, I often get the, oh, my phone must be listening to me because I was talking to my friend about, you know, this shirt. And the next thing you knew, I got an ad for the shirt. And, you know, I always kind of have a good news, bad news answer to that. The good news is, probably not listening to you on your phone. And the bad news is they don't have to because you're not that unique. Other people's preferences, people are micro created into these little categories. And so you end up getting the ad for the thing you were talking about, not because you're the only person in the world who talks about it, but because you're not the only person in the world who talks about it, and people tend to be segmented. So again, the good news, bad news is the good news is they're not tracking you individually at that level very much. The bad news is they don't have to because they've got you segmented into, you know, mom with two dogs and, you know, a bad chewy habit, which would probably be me. And so the result for you is the same, which is you are tracked and that tracking is organized and analyzed in ways that are increasingly marshaled against you. And we're beginning to see, I think people are beginning to see a lot more clearly the against you part of that, where we're starting to see what we call price discrimination, where the amount that you pay for something is based upon the fact that the companies who are charging you have all this other information about you and your ability to pay and your desperation for the thing that leads to you being charged a higher price than you might otherwise be charged. We just saw a report out of the New York Times about this, about home insurance, where people's credit rating was being used to decide as part of deciding how much they paid for home insurance. And what they decided is if you've got poor credit, they can charge you more for home insurance and you will pay it. They know that you will pay more for home insurance if you've got a weaker credit score. I suspect in other situations it might be flipped, where if they know you've got more money, they're going to charge you more for certain things. But, you know, I think that strikes a lot of people as really unfair. And it's a result of this surveillance business model kind of coming to its natural conclusion. Now that they've got all this information, they're tracking us all the time, and they've got the analytical ability to set prices, you know, dynamically, and they don't have to set one price for everyone, then they're going to start trying to maximize how much they can pull out of your wallet for each transaction. And we're starting to see that more. Of course, we see it on the other side as well, which is the kinds of things you get ads for are based upon who they think you are. And there's a famous, somewhat dated now, Facebook story about how women who were doing job searches on Facebook would not see ads for CEOs or higher paid jobs. They'd see ads for housekeepers and secretaries and things that are traditionally female jobs. And I don't think it's because Facebook was evil. It's because when you feed in data about the jobs that people have traditionally had, it's going to spit out the same jobs. That's another area where the fact that they're tracking who we are results in, you know, really, I think, horrifically discriminatory experiences online that can really affect us, that really impact people's lives in a real way.
And on top of all that, here comes AI. Cindy mentioned earlier that harassment on the internet is hard to deal with, not because it's different from real world behavior, but because our real world tools to deal with harassment are so poor. I pointed out to Cindy that because large language model artificial intelligence is based on the sum of human content on the internet, and that content is often sexist, not to mention racist and just plain factually incorrect, we have a bigger problem looming.
there's a whole field of AI research called alignment and other kinds of things that are trying to combat that, but they're kind of trying to put a Band-Aid on something and adjust it. And it's hard to marshal the resources to fix them. And public input into these things could be a helpful way to get started. I think a comprehensive privacy law that just says you don't get to spy on people as your business model would be another way to go about it, and maybe a little quicker.
My final question for Cindy was about age verification requirements, which are being promoted as keeping kids from harm on social media and online pornography. Cindy says that age verification can work for pornography websites, but when the push is for a broader and vaguer sense of online safety for kids, she and EFF hear warning bells.
What they're trying to do is to say age appropriate for anything that might be harmful to kids. And that's a much broader term. And it includes things where I don't think everybody agrees. If you go to a red state and you talk to conservative people, they don't think having access to LGBTQ content or trans content, they think that harms kids. So I don't think anything, you know, most of the pornography sites are charging and they need identification. I think that the thing that we're fighting now with a lot of the age gating is this idea that some stuff is harmful to kids, and that's a much broader category, and it's why EFF is so concerned and think it's a really bad idea. Because if we don't have a shared agreement about what's harmful to kids, then you're just handing a censorship tool to people. And so you can get really tricky. Like, we've spent years trying to help women who have breastfeeding forums continue to have their forums when they get flagged for nudity because somebody's taking a picture and saying, like, she's not latching, how does this work? Or I've got this, you know, rash or something, what does this look like? And they get flagged as pornography. So again, I think that we have to be really careful when we think about how we want to respond to these problems. And it's quite often women who end up getting sideswiped worse by these kinds of things, because a lot of women's health depends on us being able to be honest about our bodies, and it gets labeled pornography by a set of people who, if they're in charge, that's what happens. And I've spent probably the most consistent amount of time over the 25 years I've been at EFF trying to make sure that women can talk about breastfeeding online as I've done almost anything else because of society's uncomfortableness with women's bodies.
Cindy Cohen wrote a book, a legal memoir called Privacy's Defender, about her work with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Although the book chronicles the losses alongside the wins, it offers an essentially optimistic and positive view of this online world we've found ourselves in.
There are real problems, and I, you know, obviously I've spent my life trying to fight for a better online world, and we have not finished with what we're doing. But sometimes I think it's easy to miss what we've gained. I'm in New York City, and I think you're in Santa Cruz, and we are having a real-time conversation that I'm not worried about how much this is going to cost me, right? It's a whole new way for people to stay connected that didn't exist in the same way before we had this. I'm watching all of the organizing that's happening right now against the excesses of this administration. It's all organized, you know, online, even if there's offline in-person things, which are really important. It's a mix. It's not one or the other, right? And they feed each other, and people are using the tools. I wish that more people were able to use more private tools, but that's happening. This organizing is being made possible because of the digital network. So I still am excited about the prospect of that. We have to fight. You know, John Perry Barlow once told me, no one gives you your rights, you have to take them.
Women know that we have to take our rights, and we've worked hard to do it. But the job is never done, and the online world offers new and confusing challenges. Do we protect our privacy and the privacy of those we disagree with? Thanks to Cindy Cohen of the Electronic Frontier Foundation for speaking with me and explaining the challenges so clearly. You can find more information and some excellent tools for safeguarding yourself and those you love at EFF.org. For Wings, this is Suki Wessling of the Babblery. Learn more about my show at babblery.com. The song Silence is courtesy of Unwoman at unwoman.com. Thanks for listening.
Wings thanks all our support